Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Dungeons and Dragons. I'm Sebastian, and I am here with Richard.
Hi, Sebastian.
If you couldn't tell by that depressed pause, Richard is here to discuss Dungeons and Dragons with me. Not the new film that's coming out at the end of the month, which is getting surprisingly good advance notice, but the 2000 film Dungeons and Dragons, which was a massive commercial and critical failure. But before we get into that, Richard, I'd like to have you plug some of the projects that you're involved in when you come on here. Do you have anything to plug this episode?
I do, and thank you for always asking, Sebastian. This one's kind of fun. I wasn't directly involved in it, but I sort of had some oversight on it. I was lucky enough to work on the How to Train Your Dragon franchise a few years ago, and that included co-writing some of the comics with the writer-director of the movies, Dean DeLuan. We were supposed to do three. We only did two. For various businessy things that I'll never understand. The fan outcry for that missing third graphic novel has only grown over the years, especially because I mentioned that we were going to have a shirtless Hiccup in it, a Hiccup, the main character.
Nice.
He got kind of buff in the last couple of movies, and that was sort of an underwater adventure. He'd have to take off his wet tunic, and thus was born the shirtless Hiccup hashtag. So I recommend everyone check it out. We had an art contest where Dragon fans would draw their best shirtless Hiccup. The How to Train Dragon fans are some of the most talented and the horniest fans out there. And so if you want to see some sweaty, delicious, shirtless Hiccup action, definitely check out the shirtless Hiccup hashtag. We had a couple of grand prize winners. They got some goodies from the Dragon Vault. And it's a really neat array of different styles, skill levels, interpretations, and it's kind of cool to look at.
That is awesome. I love that the fans are so horny. I think we need more horniness in fantasy.
Agreed.
And I think it's safe to say that whatever your involvement is with the How to Train Your Dragon franchise, it's better than this dragon-related franchise, or at least this entry of the dragon-related franchise.
Yeah, this will kill any horniness you have ever felt in your entire life. There's one specific scene I'm thinking of.
Well, that is an awesome plug, Richard, and I strongly suggest that our listeners go check out that hashtag. But in the meantime, let's get to talking about Dungeons and Dragons from 2000. Now, before we talk about the movie itself, Richard, do you have a history with the game Dungeons and Dragons?
Not as much as I would have liked. I remember being a kid and visiting my cousins in Philadelphia, and for Christmas they had gotten this really beautiful Dungeons and Dragons. It almost looked like a chessboard and had these beautiful pewter figurines, and that was kind of my first introduction to it. But in my hometown of Miami, we didn't, Dungeons and Dragons really wasn't a thing at the time, or if it was, I didn't know about it. None of my friends were into it. But I did watch the cartoon, the Saturday morning cartoon, and loved it. I now am friends with plenty of people who were, you know, DMs and things like that. So I know about it that way. But no, I'm not an active player, unfortunately.
I was big time into Dungeons and Dragons for a window of about 3 or so years. I got into it when I was about 10 years old, which was around the time the game really took off in the early 80s. And I loved it. I was big into like Greek mythology. And so the whole sword and sorcery genre really captured my imagination, especially at that point. I had a bunch of friends who are DMs. My favorite DM now runs bookshop.org, Andy Hunter. He's
awesome.
A successful CEO, and he was my dungeon master from the age of like 9 to 11 or so. And yeah, I loved Dungeons and Dragons, the game. I then, you know, discovered rock and roll and hormones and stuff. And so I moved away from it then. It was sort of funny at that point, you know, it would have been considered sort of nerdy and frowned upon as you entered into high school in the early 80s. But now it's become so popular again. I think it's actually like that stigma is gone. You can play D&D when you're a preteen. You can play D&D when you're an adult. I mean, Joe Manganiello, I guess, runs this really high profile Hollywood hipster D&D game that everybody wants to get in. So yeah, that stigma is gone, and I'm happy about that because I think Dungeons and Dragons is a really great game to stimulate the imagination and get people interested in storytelling and character design and character building. I think it's actually an awesome tool for the creative mind.
I agree. I also wonder how much of like its recent popularity just has to do with Stranger Things.
Yeah, I think in a large way. But even going back to like Freaks and Geeks, like there was a big subplot about it in Freaks and Geeks, which was really kind of accurate to my experience playing the game in the 80s. That was one of the great things about that show, was it was really the first time that I felt like somebody actually nailed it. Like, oh, that's what it was like in the early 80s. And so I think it's great that one of the actors in that show is one of the writers and directors of the new movie, because that totally makes sense. And from all accounts, they really managed to nail the fun of playing Dungeons and Dragons in the new movie. But we're not talking about the new movie. We're talking about the 2000 version. Now, Richard, do you have any history with this movie?
Sort of. Right after I moved to LA, which was in 2000, there used to be these kind of mini Comic-Cons at the Shrine by USC, where they used to hold Oscars way back when. And they weren't great comic conventions, but yeah, they're small, they were fine. And every now and then they would have people come and promote upcoming genre movies. Arnold Schwarzenegger was there one year with the, was it Sixth Day?
Oh yeah.
And Michael Rooker's in that movie. And I got to use the urinal next to Michael Rooker's in the bathroom there. That
was my God.
My brush with fame. Amazing. Really nice guy. He was wearing old denim. And then, but one of the movies that came and presented there was Dungeons and Dragons. And a good chunk of the cast was there, not Jeremy Irons, but pretty much everyone else. And then the director was there, and I think he may have also been involved in the writing of it. And they showed some clips, and, you know, it didn't look great from the clips. And then, you know, when it came out in theaters, the reviews weren't so hot. So I did not go see it. And that's kind of rare for me. Usually, if it's anything even remotely genre related, I'll go and check it out and support it, even if it's not supposed to be fabulous.
Well, I'm sorry that had to change.
Yeah, me too.
I sadly do have a history with this film. I also had moved to Los Angeles right around the time this came out, and I was living in Atwater Village with my friend Kelly Bray, who is known as Kelfire on Instagram, who, like me, was a big sci-fi fantasy nerd, and we just couldn't resist the lure of this movie for whatever reason, and we ended up going to see it at the Americana, which I believe is pretty much right down the street from where you live right now in Glendale. I remember specifically seeing it there. So, you know, see, this was all meant to be, Richard, that you'd be talking about this movie.
Yeah, like a curse.
Yeah, and we saw it, and I just remember the experience of watching it with him where we were pretty much mortified from the beginning to the end, especially by the end. I think we were both just absolutely ashamed of our lives, of everybody involved in the movie, of the fact that we had actually paid to see this movie. Yeah, it was a really memorable experience. It was one of those experiences where I could remember the feeling of how bad the movie was. Like, I could just recall that feeling of being like, that cringy feeling of just knowing that you're in a terrible, terrible movie.
Yeah, I that's probably the biggest emotion I feel besides anger is pity. You know, just when I watch this movie, I feel so bad for everyone involved, you know, and just across the board. It's really sad. And I think one of the things that I did respond to when they premiered it or showed part of it at that Comic-Con was the director just saying how, like, he had championed this movie for, you know, like a decade at that point, or maybe over, and had gotten the rights young somehow, and just nobody wanted to make this movie and kept pushing and pushing and finally got it made. And yeah, it's like a great sort of underdog narrative and you want to support that. But then you watch the movie and it's just, I don't know, it's just really bad from start to finish.
So yeah, unfortunately, we're going to have to lay a lot of that blame on the shoulders of director and writer Courtney Solomon, because, you know, although it was really admirable that he got to sort of shepherd this project through so many years and hold on to it, he ended up sort of directing it himself because he couldn't basically get anyone else to do it. You know, I mean, some of the names they threw around, I think, were ridiculous, people that never would have done it, like James Cameron and Francis Ford Coppola. Like, there's no way either of those guys would have ever directed this, no matter what. But, you know, they could have gotten some hack jobber who at least had made some big budget movies before. And I think this guy just didn't have it in him to be able to pull this off.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, just even like shooting kind of basic coverage seems to be missing from this movie.
Yeah, it seems like a movie that was not made by a fully professional operation.
Yeah.
I mean, although I think that for the most part, like in terms of the technical details, you know, the cinematography is fine. We'll talk about the CG, which is atrocious. But the editing is mostly okay. But yes, there are definitely things that are really out of whack. And I definitely feel like the actors don't really have anybody guiding them in any sort of like meaningful way. And you can sort of tell that they're sort of cast adrift for the most part.
Yeah, the tone is all over the place in this movie. Some of the comedy is super duper broad, where it almost feels like it's for children, and other parts are just really kind of dark and kind of rapey at one point.
Well, let's talk about one of the actors in this movie, probably the biggest name and the best performance, I'm going to say. And the movie opens with him. We meet Jeremy Irons' character, Profion the Wizard. Now, Profion to me sounds like, I don't know, some sort of like erectile dysfunction medicine or something like that. But I do have to say that Jeremy Irons is perhaps the one pleasure that you can take away from this movie. I mean, he's just hamming it up in such a ridiculous fashion that at least I enjoy watching him when he's on screen.
I guess. I mean, you know, I don't know. When I start watching, I was like, well, maybe he's got like a kid or a grandkid who, you know, liked Dungeons and Dragons and he's doing the movie for them.
Right.
I mean, I think that's why Raul Julia was in Street Fighter, the, you know, the live action movie. I think it's because he had a kid or someone who loved playing the game. So I looked it up and no, Jeremy Irons had just bought a castle and I think was like having refurbished. So he took the job for the money. And then he just goes hog wild in this movie.
That would be cool if they actually shot this scene in his new castle that he just bought. But it's not. It's actually this famous like ossuary that they managed to use to film in. So I don't know. That's kind of cool. I will say that some of the sets in this are kind of half decent looking for what they are. And I do like this set. Now, the story that they're setting up here, though, is a bit of a head scratcher. I mean, he's trying to gain control of red dragons or something like that.
Are you asking me? I have no idea, Sebastian. I'm so lost from the beginning. He has like a staff, right?
Yes.
That's the other thing. They don't call them staffs in this movie. They call them rods. And everyone's after a rod. And it's like, come on, guys.
You said this movie isn't very horny, but yeah. I don't know. Everybody's chasing after a rod.
But isn't it like in fantasy? It's always a staff. It's a wizard's staff, right?
Yeah.
It's a rod. Yeah. So they're trying to get this hard rod that's hard to get. And I just don't understand. I'm not trying to be cute. I really don't know what's going on here. There's like these guys in monk robes turning all this ancient machinery, and it's making this rod spin around in kind of like an armillary. And then Propheon gets his rod and he thinks he can control dragons with it, but then he can't.
I think it's just a fake out kind of setup of like, oh, he needs a rod. He needs a good hard rod so that he can control these red dragons. But oops, it doesn't work. We have to talk about the dragon. I mean, as a animator and as a person who writes about dragons, is this the worst dragon ever put on film?
Yeah, I'm going to say yes. And I don't mean that as like any disrespect to the, I'm sure, very talented people who worked on it and animated it. But it's just the way it's used in this scene. It's lit really brightly. There's kind of like no surprise or majesty about the dragon. It just comes out and gets killed almost instantly. And there's nothing like, I really wish it was a practical dragon that was designed by like a Stan Winston or somebody like that. I think they could have gotten a lot more emotion out of it and made us care more for this dragon in the beginning if it was just a little more expressive or just shot a little differently. But instead, it's this kind of lame-looking CG dragon that gets killed right off the bat, and you don't feel much for it.
No, not at all. You can't feel anything for it because it has about as much verisimilitude as a PS1 game character. And I'm not trying to besmirch the CG artists either. I'm sure they had like $10 to make this thing. I mean, it's clearly a budgetary issue. But yeah, even the design of it is just not very appealing. It's got this sort of long snout. It's a disaster, honestly. And like from right off the bat, you're seeing this creature, like right up into that moment, even with all the nonsensical stuff that's going on, you think like, okay, well, we might have something here. And then as soon as you see that dragon,
you're checked out.
You're like, nope, this whole movie's fucked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's within the first like 20 seconds or something, like maybe a minute, you know, and you're done, you're out. Like it's that devastatingly bad.
This movie didn't learn the lesson from Jaws, right? Like, wasn't the mechanical shark in that malfunctioning all the time? And yes. So they just had to edit around it and edit it out. And so there's only this big reveal at the end. And by that point, the viewer's imagination has kind of filled in all the pieces and you think this shark must look awesome. If they had just cut out this opening scene, I think the rest of the movie would feel 50% better.
They could at least move along and trick you into thinking you might be getting a good dragon at the end. Because, I mean, the franchise is called Dungeons and Dragons. You at least have to provide a dungeon, which they managed to do, and a dragon. And the dragon is so abysmally terrible that, yeah, you're done at this point. But we're not done. We have to continue.
Ah, kill me. All right.
We have to continue and talk about Damodar, Propheon's right-hand man, his majordomo, so to speak, the Darth Vader of this film, played by British actor Bruce Payne. He's got a shaved head and this kind of sort of plasticky-looking red and black armor. And he's also got electric blue lipstick on.
Yeah. A terrifying figure. Yeah.
It has to be one of the most bizarre character design choices ever put into a sci-fi fantasy film.
Yeah, it's not like the rest of him is sort of like atypically colored. Like, he just looks like a bald white guy wearing blue lipstick.
Right.
And it's never expressed. It's not like he's part of like some group of mages and they use a certain kind of ice spell and it makes their lips blue. No, he just has blue lips. And this is the guy I feel the sorriest for in this entire movie, because he looks ridiculous, and what he's asked to do throughout this film is just humiliating.
Because not only is he going to have to walk around and try to be intimidating with this ridiculous character design element, but Jeremy Irons' Profion, to enslave him, I guess, puts in this sort of double-headed brain worm into Damodar's head. And so we're going to get throughout the movie these shots of like Damodar going like, no, and this, that bad sort of like 90s CG where you see something moving under the skin. And then these like Mortal Kombat-like CG earworms come out. I mean, this movie felt a lot like Mortal Kombat Annihilation to me in a lot of ways, which, if you haven't seen that movie, good on you.
You're not going to trick me into watching that one, Sebastian. I learned my lesson with Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, and they both were made by, you know, New Line Cinema and stuff, which ironically, a year later, New Line's going to release Lord of the Rings, which is going to completely change the landscape of this type of fantasy film. But this is almost like the punishment before you get there. Like,
this is the disgusting vegetable you have to eat before getting the dessert that is Lord of the Rings. Yeah. 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 No, these earworm things, a lot of times they just look like tulips coming out of the side of his head. And when they first spring out, the actor, he's like grunting and acting so much pain and discomfort. It's really upsetting to watch. And then the things that come out are these stupid cartoon flowers, basically.
Yeah.
And then his ears, like the ears themselves, they just look like red and infected for the rest of the movie. So he's got these red ears, these blue lips, and this stupid armor. I feel so bad for this guy.
Darth Vader, he is not. No. Not scaring anyone. Well, let's move on and talk about our heroes. Ridley, as played by Lois and Clark, I believe's Justin Whalen. He was Jimmy Olsen in that show, if you remember it at all. And Snails, as played by Marlon Wayans. Whalen and Wayans. It's like a comedy duo.
I'm sure Marlon Wayans would be happy to not have his name on this movie.
Yeah, this has to be a dark stain on his resume, right? Like, he probably doesn't even mention this.
No, and he made White Chicks, and I'm this is the movie he doesn't want to talk about.
Now, of these two characters, I don't like either. And let's just like put that out there up front. Like, when I say something positive about either the performance or the character, that's only relative to everything else. Like, I don't like any of these characters, and I don't think any of these performances are good. But, you know, we're grading on a scale here, and the scale goes way, 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 way down. So it's like, I'm not a fan of Justin Whalen. It's kind of just his face, and I hate to put it in those terms, but he's just got a punchable face, and he looks really 90s with his like hair cut in this. It's kind of reminds me a little of a Treasure Planet character. He's sort of wearing this like musketeer like jacket, which I actually think is kind of cool in its own way, but he's probably the better or the more tolerable performance overall between the two of them. Because the way that Wayans' Snails character is written is just fingernails on a chalkboard irritating, to me at least. I mean, he's supposed to be the comic relief, obviously, because it's Marlon Wayans, but he's kind of the chicken shit of the two, and he's always like, why are we going to do that? Why? Like, almost veering on Jar Jar Binksy step and fetch it moments, which I just find him the more irritating of the two. It sucks because Marlon's probably the more talented of the two, but it's really just the way his character is written that annoys the shit out of me.
It's not just you. It annoyed me too. And I actually really like Marlon Wayans. I like the whole Wayans family. And I don't understand why he did this movie. It couldn't have been for the money, because I don't think it's, I can't imagine it was that big a payday. But I read at the same time he was making this, he was making Requiem for a Dream. And he's great in that.
Yeah.
So I'd like talk about night and day, but I think that's just goes back to your point of like the directing is the problem here, because he's just so dialed up to 11, and Marlon Wayans keeps picking up parts of like the background set dressing and carrying them around with him in scenes. And it just shows off how cheap they are up close. Like if they're left in the background, be okay. In this scene where they're breaking into the magic school, I think that's the name of it. It's just magic school.
Right. There's a lot of things that are just called magic this or magic that. Like they don't come up with actual names for them. It's just the magic school or the magic thing.
Later on, they're going to be in the magic tavern. And the, yeah, it just, anyway, so they break into magic school and Marlon Wayne's snails, sorry, is carrying like what's supposed to be a dragon's tooth and some other thing. But the way he's carrying them, you could see they're just made out of styrofoam. They weigh nothing. And if he had just left it in the background, maybe it would look kind of cool. And then there's a scene later on where they're outside at some market and there's like a fake cat sitting somewhere. And as he's running off the scene, he grabs the cat.
And then he's like putting it on like Justin Whalen's shoulder or something. It's like he's just fucking around with a prop.
Oh, it's such a mess. But yeah, so they break into magic school, and my favorite part about this, and kind of this happens a lot in the movie, they show the characters like kind of creeping around, but it almost looks like little kids like sort of doing these exaggerated tiptoes where they're stooped over and they're kind of like lightly glancing through the room. Justin Whalen does this throughout the movie.
Right. It's like Scooby-Doo posture.
Yeah. All that's missing is like a little twinkling sound effect of their toes skittering across the feet, the floor. So yeah, anyway, that's magic school.
I mean, we should say that the reason they're doing this is that they're thieves, which it's funny because I did notice some cosmetic similarities between this movie and the movie that we're going to get in a few weeks.
Oh, no.
I mean, that's all about thieves too. And I don't know, it does seem like they kind of looked at this movie in a way and were like, we could maybe do that better. But there's also this really like lazy and tiresome sort of political situation of there's the mages. And can I just say, I hate that word for some reason. Like, I know it's been used in other fantasy series, but it annoys me for whatever reason. Like, it's just obviously, just say wizard, okay? Just say sorcerer. Like, don't give me this mage shit. But there's this mage class, and then there's the commoners, and of course they're from the commoners. And, you know, the mages are these snooty wizards who lord their power over everybody. And the, you know, tiresome political situation that's going on here is we have Empress Savina, played by Thora Birch. Okay, so speaking of like performances that happened the same year, the year before she's in American Beauty, this year she's going to be in Ghost World, which she's fantastic in. And yeah, then she's in this movie doing like a Natalie Portman in Phantom Menace kind of performance. It's so strange because you wonder, how is somebody who's obviously got talent not able to pull off this shit, right? I do feel that some people can't pull off the pseudo Shakespeare crap, right? You know what I mean? There's just some actors who just can't do it. And I feel that poor Thora Birch is one of those actors. And she, you know, she just looks silly in her like dresses and everything. She just looks like a little kid dressed up like a princess or something. It's abysmally bad.
It doesn't help that she's also wearing these headdresses that are really distracting. There's one where there's like these little gems that are dangling off of like this crown on her forehead. And so every time she talks and moves her head, they just kind of jingle around. It's, again, I just feel bad. I just feel bad.
And they're trying to set up, I guess, this whole thing where she's really, I don't know, a fan of the proletariat, and she's going to make things equal between the mages and the commoners, which I don't know how you do when one side has magical powers and one side doesn't.
Raise taxes. I don't know.
I'm all for equality, but how does that work exactly when one person can turn you into like a frog and the other person can't find food to eat? So the whole time we're getting this sort of tiresome thing where Justin Whalen wants to really stick it to those snooty mages. And so, of course, when they break into magic school, the first person they meet is this cute librarian mage who's gonna, you know, be his love interest, and they're going to, you know, bicker about who's better, the commoners and the mages. This character is Marina, played by Zoe McClellan, who I don't remember seeing in anything before this or after, but I guess she has gone on to do some TV or whatever. Again, I don't want to be mean to any of these actors. Her performance in particular feels like a performance that is desperate for direction and not getting any, because she's just kind of like so keyed up the whole time. Like everything she's saying, like, mages aren't so mean, you need to blah, blah, blah. And it's like that kind of nagging character. And we're supposed to be sort of falling for her, and you know, she's attractive and I like myself a cute librarian and all that, but she's kind of just terrible in this movie, and I feel bad for saying that, but again, I think the fault is on the director here.
Yeah, I don't think she was given much to work with. I mean, she's a mage too, right?
Like, yes.
she there's some points where she has some magic powers, and yet she's constantly getting captured and is being made to be like this helpless character that just wants to be rescued by Ridley all the time. I don't know. Also, Marina is wearing glasses when we first meet her, but
yeah,
they look like the glasses you're wearing right now in 2023, Sebastian. And like the old librarian she's working for, he's wearing these glasses too. And they aren't like the cool half moon wizard ones that just rest on the bridge of your nose. They're just like,
nope,
you know, from Lens Crafters. It's right. The production design's all over the place. To the point where I wonder if it's like the Starbucks cup in Game of Thrones. Like maybe the actress really wears glasses and was looking at her sides and then forgot to take them off before they called action, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and the clothing in this, it's that kind of heightened fantasy sort of clothes where, I mean, it doesn't look like legitimate medieval era style clothing. It's much more, you know, exaggerated and tailored and different fabrics, which is all, you know, fine.
Sure.
And we're going to see that in the new Dungeons and Dragons movie. I don't necessarily mind that. But yeah, it doesn't at all cohere into any sort of like tangible world. You just feel like, oh, the costume designer is doing one thing and the set designer is kind of doing another. And oh, who cares? We'll just throw in a real pair of glasses.
Yeah, why not?
One of the costumes that I felt was notable, though, was the one worn by Norda, the Elven Ranger, played by Kristen Wilson. She's got this like really buxom silver breastplate, which is, you know, sort of unfortunate because the actress looks like she has sort of like a slender physique, and so they're clearly going for some sort of TNA appeal, but it's this like horrible piece of plastic she has to wear.
In my mind, that breastplate was sculpted by the same person who put the nipples on the bat suit.
I was thinking exactly the same thing.
I mean, I even think, believe me, I could not look at this thing. There are sort of like embossed nipples on it too, on Norda's breastplate. So
again, I don't want to keep harping on the acting here, but I feel her performance is terrible. She's kind of trying to do the pseudo Shakespeare thing because she's like an elf and it's not working, but I will give them points forward thinking diversity wise because she is a person of color playing an elf. And there was just recently a big kerfuffle about this for the new Lord of the Rings show with a black elf. And hey, look, you know, we were doing it in 2000 in Dungeons and Dragons. So They definitely get points in that regard.
Maybe that's the problem with this movie. It was just way ahead of its time. We just don't get it still.
You know, I know I've sort of jumped ahead here talking about her character. She's been tasked with tracking down these thieves by the Thora Birch character, I believe. But one thing that sort of annoys me with the diversity element of it is that because she's black and Marlon Wayans's character is black, of course, like, he's going to be all into her. You know what I mean? Like, why couldn't she be the love interest for Justin Whalen or whatever? Two steps forward, one step back here with the diversity, because he's all into her. And the joke is that, you know, she's a 200-year-old elf and he's a 23-year-old guy, so it'll never work or whatever. It just means we get tiresome scenes where Marlon Wayans is hitting on her.
I have nothing to add. I just, I don't want to think about it. Let's move on.
We did sort of skip over another important member of our party, because like all D&D games, and I'll give them credit for this, you always end up in a tavern or something in every single D&D game, because that's where you sort of get your quest. This isn't where the quest begins in this movie. The quest begins in the magic school when they look at this scroll, which has got a map on it. We're going to get like three different MacGuffins in this movie, you know, this sort of fetch quest type of plot where you need this map to get this Eye of the Dragon, and you need that Eye of the Dragon to get into the dungeon where you get the pulsating red rod. That's our plot. That's all we need to say about that. You're just going from one place to another to get one item, which is, you know, not untrue to Dungeons and Dragons, and I'm sure we'll see that in the new movie. But we get the scene where they go to this tavern and they meet this slovenly dwarf who's going to join the party. We're talking a fantasy dwarf here, not a real life dwarf. The dwarf is played by Lee Arenberg, who I believe is Rigetti in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, or his partner, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I believe it's the same actor.
I did not recognize him.
When we meet him, he's sort of like chowing down on...
No, that's not where we meet him. They meet him like in a pile of garbage outside the magic school. He's like a homeless dwarf? I just don't know.
They're trying to escape the blue-lipped Daemadar. He's chasing after them, and they go to hide in this like hovel that says no dwarves allowed. There's a sign outside, yet there's going to be a dwarf in there, and that leads to the sewers.
Yes. The plot is really intricate, Sebastian, so I just want to make sure we're tracking it, okay?
I literally just watched this movie like 2 hours ago or whatever, and I've already forgotten key bits of connective details for sure.
I get why you're associating him with the tavern, because when they're there, the dwarf is just eating all this chicken, and it's hanging out of his mouth, like through so many shots. Nobody eats like this in fantasy movies or anywhere else. It just was crazy. And again, it's like, who's this movie for?
Yeah, it's literally huge chunks of chicken and skin are just, and he's talking and it's just sort of quivering in his mouth. Like,
gross.
You know, it's shorthand. He's a slob. He lives by the sewer or whatever. I mean, this character amounts to a giant hill of nothing pretty much in the whole movie, as do most of the characters other than Justin Whalen's character. Like, they're just going to keep contriving reasons why he has to do the thing alone or whatever. It's like, why do we even have a party of heroes if they're not all going to do something?
But none of them are good at their jobs. Ridley and Snails are not good thieves.
No.
The marine is not a good mage. This guy, the dwarf, he isn't even a dwarf. He's as tall as the rest of them.
Yeah. Like,
in some scenes, he's kind of squatting down a little bit, but whatever. And then the Daemadar is always behind them. He never seems like a credible threat as a bad guy.
No.
Profion is just kind of wearing pajamas later on, like when they're in like the opera house or something, and he's arguing with Thora Birch, and they have this really silky, flowy robes.
Yeah, that scene is especially boring too. I mean, it harkens back to the worst moments in like The Phantom Menace, of which there Phantom are a lot Menace. Of bad moments. But I mean, yeah, this movie came out a year later, and you know, I don't think there was probably any, you know, knowledge of what Phantom Menace was going to be, but it does call back to that movie in some unfortunate ways. And I remember at the time just thinking that while I was watching it, because, you know, I had really not liked The Phantom Menace. And then watching this movie in the theater, I'm like, God, is this is like what movies are going to be now? Is this what fantasy sci-fi is going to be? Is boring meetings in council chambers with bad costuming and people arguing about political situations that I don't give a shit about?
Trade embargoes. That's what fantasy fans want. That's what we're here for.
But we'll get back to that, just because one of the most inexplicable cuts in the film happens around there, and you're like, what the fuck is going on? But in the meantime, we've got to go to the Thieves Guild. They need to go there to get the Eye of the Dragon. One nice thing we get here is we get Richard O'Brien of Rocky Horror as the Zilius, the head of the Thieves Guild.
These names.
It's kind of fun to see him hamming it up here, right?
Yes. I think this is one of the few good performances.
And this whole scene is basically going to be, you know, a situation where Justin Weiland's character, Ridley, has to get the Eye of the Dragon, which for whatever reason is just hidden in this maze. And so they have these sort of gladiatorial-like contests where you run through this, like, subpar Raiders of the Lost Ark type of maze. And at one point, Ridley's got to jump up on these swinging pendulums. And at another part, he's got to, like, stab these triggers in the ground that set off flamethrowers, and then he's got to get past these spiked rollers and stuff. It's just kind of ridiculous Raiders of the Lost Ark leftovers.
Yeah, it's also not a maze. It's just like three rooms that are in a straight line. So, I mean, there's traps and stuff. I get it, but it's not a maze.
And I guess it's like down below and everybody just watches from above as he goes through the maze. They don't establish geography very well in this movie at all. And this is one of those situations where you're like, what's going on here? To your point, you said Ridley wasn't very good at things, but I mean, he's good at getting through this maze and no one else has ever survived it to get this magical rock. So
I take it back. He's the best thief ever. You're right. I'm wrong.
But yeah, so Ridley manages to get the Eye of the Dragon, which is just this gem that's just going to get us to our next thing. But then Richard O'Brien's like, oh, well, I'm not going to let you keep that gem. I'm wondering, like, really, is this the first time anyone has managed to get this gem? Like, all anybody does is sit around here all day by this maze, and this is the first time anyone's managed to pull this off.
Couldn't they just climb down from, like, the top where they were observing the maze? Couldn't somebody just lean down and grab the Eye of the Dragon or Tiger or whatever?
Exactly, or get, like, a grappling hook or something and just lower it down there and grab. There has to be a better way to do this.
You know, I think there's even a line where, so that he gets double-crossed by the Thieves Guild, and there's, like, some line about no honor among thieves. And isn't that the subtitle of the new Dungeons, right?
It is.
I think you're right. I think this is like a shadow requel, this new movie that we're getting.
They actually made two direct-to-video sequels to this movie, if you can believe that. I have never seen them, and I never will, but they exist.
I did not know that. Wow.
But yeah, no, there's weird echoes in this new movie. I see a little bit of Dungeons & Dragons 2000 in the new one. But yeah, so Damodar shows up, and that's so that the heroes can get away and go on to their next adventure. Before we move on to that, though, I do want to bring up the very small inclusion of some notable Dungeons & Dragons monsters. As somebody who doesn't play the game, these might not have meant anything to you. But, like, other than the dragons, the red dragons and the gold dragons, in D&D there's a bunch of different types of dragons. But another notable monster that we see in this are the Beholders. And yeah, that's when they go to that other campsite and you see those, like, floating heads with, like, tentacle eyes coming off of them.
Those I recognize. But again, they don't do anything in this movie, right?
No, they don't even have a scene where they, like, are fighting the Beholders or anything like that. They're just sort of thrown in there like Easter eggs. There's other sort of Star Trek-y characters that we see, like, you know, in the tavern. You know, they're trying to do kind of like a Star Wars cantina type of thing where you see these sort of like lizard men, and there's this one purple guy that they talk to with like a third eye, which I don't know if he's actually a specific D&D character, but that's what you get here in terms of world building and references to the game. I mean, I think that's one area where this new movie is definitely going to be a major improvement. I've noticed just from the trailer that they've gone hog wild with all the different D&D characters and monsters and stuff like that. So this movie fails pretty big time in that regard.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like what you're saying about how Lord of the Rings, how those movies change the game with fantasy. But I just think adaptations in general, like, you know, the first X-Men movie was in 2000 also, wasn't it?
Yep.
And I feel like prior to that, a lot of the, you know, superhero movies or comic book adaptation movies, like, they really downplayed the comic bookiness of it. And there wouldn't be that many references to the source material. And ever since Lord of the Rings and, like, the success of X-Men and the Spider-Man movies, like, the Marvel movies now, a big part of their success is how faithful they are to the source material. So it's hard to imagine that a Dungeons & Dragons movie coming out now would not embrace all the source material from the games. And yet this one from 2000, it just doesn't add up that the director was this huge fan of the games and dedicated so much of his life to making this movie, and yet the movie has, as near as I can tell, very little to do with the game.
Well, I think that what you're talking about was a major shift in the sort of attitude with the studios. I think, you know, the attitude was like, we're kind of ashamed of this, you know, comic book property, or we're kind of ashamed of this tabletop game property. So we want to try to make it accessible to as many people as possible. So we don't want so much insider baseball stuff. So we're going to take as much of that stuff out as we can. And I think culture just shifted so completely. And I mean, I think that the internet plays a huge part in that, because now it's all about the Easter eggs. It's all about throwing as many of these things as you can into your show or into your movie so that people will talk about them online. So people will write articles about, you know, here are all the different Easter eggs you'd find in Dungeons & Dragons. I'm sure once this new Dungeons & Dragons movie comes out, you're going to see all these entertainment articles about, this was a monster from this game and that's a monster from that game. And, you know, that's how they generate buzz now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's weird the way things have just completely gone 180 in that regard. And now it's all about cramming in as many things as you possibly can, to the detriment of things sometimes. You know, I think the Star Wars shows right now, other than Andor, are kind of suffering from that. You know, they're suffering from member berries, as they call them. Like, hey, look, there's the cantina from episode 4 or whatever. It's like, I don't care about seeing that. Just tell a good story.
Well, I don't know if this is an Easter egg, but in the background of one of these scenes, I can't remember if it's in the tavern or the Thieves Guild, there's a guy with a green face, and it just has green paint on his face.
Yeah, those are called green faces.
Oh, green faces, yeah. Well, this green face looks a lot like Bill Hader, you know, Barry and from SNL.
Oh, man.
And I know he was, you know, a PA on a lot of movies around this time, so in my mind, that's Bill Hader. I didn't stay to watch the credits to see if he was listed on there, because I was done with the movie by then. Anyway, that could be Bill Hader back there, guys.
I'm going to go ahead and say it's Bill Hader. And if Bill Hader wants to deny that, he can come on Tentpole Trauma and he can deny that he was ever a background character in Dungeons & Dragons 2000, because I'm saying it's him. I am signing off on that. It's Bill Hader.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
One of the things that happens out of this situation at the Thieves Guild is Marina is captured and tortured by Damodar, where he sort of like allows these mind worms to come out of his ears and then kind of like mind rape her or something.
Yeah, he ear rapes her. It's horrible. And they're like pulsating, like they're sucking, I don't know, brains or earwax out of her ears and then putting them into his.
Yeah, he's supposedly getting the knowledge out of her brain, I think, because she knows where the eye of the dragon is or something like that. I think that's what's going on there.
I don't know. It just made me feel really uncomfortable. I almost would have preferred to see him just kind of torture her the old-fashioned way, like on the rack or something, to get the information.
Yeah.
Than these ear things going into her ears and connecting their ears. I don't know. Really didn't like it.
It's pretty nauseating. One thing I do like that happens around this chunk of the movie, so the heroes know that they have to go save Marina. I mean, Snails doesn't want to save her, but Ridley does. So, you know, we're obviously getting that some attraction has grown between them during their constant like bickering, because we all know that's how people fall in love in movies, is by coming at things from completely opposite viewpoints. So they go to Damodar's lair, hangout, wherever he's hangout. That's another thing about this movie that gets really confusing, is they do not establish clearly where these places are necessarily. Like, we're going to get a few kind of cheesy establishing shots that are mostly CG of, like, you know, this very Coruscant looking like city. I believe that's Izmir or whatever, where they're originally from.
A few. I feel like there's dozens of those shots, and there are these long tracking shots where the camera's like soaring through all the spires, and there's like 15 of them in the first 2 minutes. I feel like that's where most of the budget went. And they're like, oh, wait, we still have to do dragons? Uh-oh.
Yeah, it was such a thing back at this time. You know, that CG technology had just sort of come into prominence. And, like, whenever you are in a world-built movie, you know, even the Batman movies, the Joel Schumacher ones would have these sort of sweeping shots where we'd be going up and down through the canyons of Gotham. And now Gotham looked like something out of a Atlas Shrugged cover or whatever, yeah. You know, like just completely overdone buildings that are a million miles high.
Statues everywhere.
Your statues everywhere. And yeah, so we're getting a lot of shots of that city. At one point, we're going to see this other like city that almost looks sort of Avatar-ish, where they've got like floating chunks of the city. I mean, it's cool in a sort of design way, but they don't amount to anything story-wise. Like, they don't fall off the edge of the city at any point, or it never factors into the story. They're just these computer shots that are thrown in there to kind of impress you. Back to that scene, one thing that I do like, and this is really not an expensive effect, but I enjoyed this, is when Snail falls into that quicksand rug.
That was really cool. That was a neat trick.
I mean, they probably just painted like a vat of oatmeal to look like a rug or whatever, and Marlon Wayans falls in it, but I don't know. I'm like, more of that, less of the CG vistas, please.
I just don't understand why we're here. I don't understand where we are or why we're here. I guess they went to rescue Marina. Ridley goes to rescue Marina, right? It's kind of like this running gag where Ridley says, I'll get the girl, and he tells Snail to get whatever's not the girl.
Yeah.
So in this case, they need the map. I don't know why they need the map, because they already got the Eye of the Dragon, but whatever. So Ridley rescues Marina, and then Snails is left to fight Damodar, right?
Yes.
And while I agree with you, I love the trap that looks like a rug, and it's oatmeal or whatever. First of all, why does Damodar have that in his own living room? Like, what if he accidentally steps in it? But no problem. The problem is Snails eventually gets out of it, and he's covered in like this oatmeal glop the rest of the time he's in the movie, including his death scene, which is about to come up. Spoilers, Snails gets killed by Damodar, but he's covered in like oatmeal. It looks like he's just been through Double Dare on Nickelodeon, and then he gets killed at the very end. He's bleeding. There's all this blood coming out of his mouth, but he's also covered in oatmeal.
Yeah, it kind of takes the drama out of the situation. First of all, I thought it was a little strange that Snails has been picked as the sacrificial character. It feels like Marlon Wayans just wanted out of this movie. So he's like, how can you fucking write me out of this? I mean, I'm willing to bet that's true.
I am too. And that's like, that to me kind of alleviates some of the racial implications of like, of course the black guy dies. But all I felt in that moment was relief. Relief for Marlon Wayans and relief for me. Was I supposed to cheer at that moment? Because I did.
It's strange that this character dies, and we've still got 40 minutes of the movie, so we're not even, you know, the beginning of the third act, you know? So it's almost like the middle of the movie, it feels like, and it's like, really? Snails is going to be the character that dies? And, you know, Ridley does the whole, no! Like the classic drop to his knees and cry out to the heavens moment.
If you didn't want to punch his face before that moment, you sure do now, because it's like trembling a lot when he's saying no. And yeah, it's boy.
But also at this point, Ridley is wounded by Damodar. He's jabbed in the shoulder. And then Marina's going to get them out of this situation by wizard portals, which I didn't realize that going all the way back to 2000, we were getting wizard portals. I feel like now we're in a world of wizard portals where just everything's a friggin' portal to somewhere. But, you know, props for forward-thinking Dungeons & Dragons with the wizard portaling.
But if she could make a wizard portal, why couldn't she get herself out of the dungeon before she was ear-raped?
That is a really good question, Richard.
We'll ask Bill Hader when he comes on. He probably knows.
This is all terrible, but I am happy, and I'll tell you why. It's because we go to this sort of fake Lothlorien elf kingdom, because our elf ranger knows a place where Ridley can get his wound healed, and there he is healed by the character of Halvarath, who is played by the great Tom Baker, who is my favorite Doctor Who. I have subscribed currently to BritBox, the app, for a month just so I can watch all of the Tom Baker Doctor Who's, because when I was a kid, I loved Doctor Who, and for whatever reason, the CBS station affiliate that I watched only had like four seasons of Tom Baker, and they would just run those four seasons over and over and over. I found out there was three more seasons of Tom Baker that I had never gotten to see, and so now I can see them. So I'm having a great middle-aged nerd moment where I'm catching up on Doctor Who episodes I never got to see. So I do love seeing him here. I mean, he doesn't do anything. He just sort of delivers this corny dialogue about how, you know, all living things are connected, blah, 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 the Force or whatever. Like, none of which has mattered up until now, but yeah, whatever.
Not at all, but he delivers it well. He can do sort of the faux Shakespearean thing that you were talking about before. And it was actually, I thought, a really nice performance for this probably like 2 hours of work. Can we talk about Doctor Who some more and not Dungeons & Dragons?
Are you a Doctor Who fan?
No, not at all. I have nothing against it. I just never got into it, but I would just rather hear you tell me about that and talk more about this movie. But that's not what the fans came for.
I will say this about watching those old Tom Baker Doctor Who's. He is amazing and charming. But the thing that was really shocking to me was just seeing how many sci-fi properties had mined ideas out of this run of this like cheesy 70s British sci-fi show, where they're like literally, you know, using like paper mache and tinfoil for some of their effects. But there was one story that had this alternate reality called The Matrix. There was just a whole bunch of stories where I was like, oh, that's where this comes from, and that's where that came from. And the thing that's so cool about it is these friggin' writers were just throwing out these amazing sci-fi concepts, just one story after another, and it's just this disposable thing, kind of like comic books, you know, like when you read 70s comic books and you're like, oh my God, this concept is incredible. And it was just dashed out for an issue of a comic book that got forgotten.
Yeah, they didn't even have time to think about it. They were just trying to hit these monthly deadlines. And yeah, a lot of those writers were writing multiple books per month.
Yeah.
So it was even more compressed. I was wondering about that a little bit with Dungeons & Dragons. Like I said, I haven't had much experience with the game. But I imagine, just like what you're saying with Doctor Who, how many fantasy things had been inspired by Dungeons & Dragons and had maybe kind of stolen some of the big moves from it, so that when you finally are making a Dungeons & Dragons movie, how do you make it so that it doesn't feel derivative?
Right.
Like, that was kind of the thing with John Carter when you covered that on the show.
Exactly.
Like, so many other sci-fi properties had kind of strip mined all the most famous things from it. So what are you left with after that?
That's the challenge, right? If you're going to do something like that. I think with Dungeons & Dragons, and it looks like the new movie has done this, and I know we're talking about this new movie as if it's great. Neither of us have seen it yet, so who knows? It may be terrible. But, you know, I think what they did, which was clever, just by looking at the trailers and from what I've heard, is that they've made it feel like it feels to play the game, you know, by throwing in all these different kind of monsters and all these sort of Easter eggy things. It's kind of the perfect property for that. You know what I mean? Because that's sort of the appeal as a player. You want to encounter all these different monsters and you have your favorite monsters that you fight and all that kind of stuff and situations like that. Plus all the different characters have their own classes. Like one's a bard and one's a, you know, magic user and one's a paladin, you know, like they're using the character classes, you know, one's a barbarian.
Right.
That's the sort of appeal with most fantasy properties. These characteristics are kind of mashed together. You know, you're not going to get somebody who's just a this or just a that. And this movie kind of tries to do that. You know, you get the elf ranger and you get the dwarf. The problem is, I mean, there's a lot of problems with this movie, but they don't do anything with them. The whole point is by having these disparate characters, because they've got these specialities, like a situation will arise where the mage will have the solution and a situation will arise where the thief has the solution or the rogue or whatever you want to call it. It's supposed to be you bring your skill set to this adventure and your skill set comes in handy somewhere. And like, that's the fun of the game. And this movie completely throws that out the window. And then it's like it thinks that Justin Whalen's the thing everybody wants to see. Sorry, Justin Whalen. He's a perfectly fine actor. I'm sure he's good in the right role, but he's not your Luke Skywalker. He's not your Han Solo. And like, there's several scenes in this movie. Like, we're going to get this scene coming up where, you know, he's got to go into the dungeon to get the rod with the Eye of the Dragon. And, you know, they're about to enter into this cavern, this dungeon, and suddenly this invisible wall just blocks out the rest of the characters. So, like, fuck you, rest of the characters. And they just sit there waiting in a field for him to get out. And, like, all he does is go in, gets the thing, a skeleton talks to him, and then he comes out and he's like, hey, guys, I got the thing.
I couldn't tell if I missed something or not, but it was never quite explained why he was able to pass that invisible wall and the others weren't. But, you know, even if there wasn't an invisible wall, it doesn't matter, because when Snails got killed, the Elf Ranger and the Dwarf were just kind of waiting around, like, on the outskirts of Damodar's stronghold, and like not once did they think, hey, maybe we should go and help. Like, they're just sitting there while Snails got his throat slit or whatever happened, and we got stabbed in the back, something.
Right. The whole point of the game is you're in a party, you're in a group, and you all have special, unique skills, and then you use them when the opportunity arrives. You can't do it alone. That's the whole point. Otherwise, you'd just be playing the game by yourself. And that just seems like one of those, like, basic things you have to get right. Like, that should be the first thing you talk about at the script meeting. It's okay, this is what the game is. How do we implement this in a way that's going to be fun for people to watch? Oh, I know. We have all these characters and they're all going to do something fun and exciting at some point during the movie, maybe multiple times. You know, that's basically how Star Wars works when it works well. You know, that's how all of these things are supposed to work when they work well. I think it's the biggest failure of this movie. And there's a lot of huge failures of this movie. But on a story level, that's the one that I find most baffling, that they keep just handing things off for Justin Whalen to do on his own. That's ridiculous and stupid and wrong.
Especially since this movie was knocking around for over a decade. Like, that's so much time that people could have been rewriting the script or just including all those key elements from the game.
It seems to me almost like some sort of bad studio note where they were like, oh, well, people are just going to want to see the hunky hero do it. And you're like, not this hunky hero. All right, well, is there anything else you want to talk about until we get to the fucking god-awful climax of this movie?
No. What was the cut that you were talking about before? It was like some...
Well, okay, so literally, like, Justin Whalen walks out of this dungeon. He's gotten the rod, right?
The rod, yeah.
And then right around this time, we just cut to this city, and all of a sudden, it's under siege by dragons. Like, I'm like, when did the dragon siege start? And friggin' Thora Birch is riding on one. I don't believe I ever see her mount the dragon at all. In terms of what the villain story has gone on, it's literally cut, not literally in terms of time in the movie, but in terms of the story. It's gone from they had, like, this argument in front of the council, right, where Jeremy Irons is like, I don't want to give any power to the people. And Thora Birch is like, I do. And then cut, dragon siege.
She's attacking with her dragons. Yeah.
Like, what happened? Like, she's attacking them with her gold dragons or something like that. Like, war has been declared off screen, apparently. And now we're just in a complete crazy dragon battle.
Just thinking about it, if Justin Whalen hadn't found that rod, then Profion wouldn't be able to use it. And, like,
right.
The Empress would have just won. It would have been okay.
Yeah.
All he had to do was just leave it in that cave.
Yeah, that's what's so confusing about it, too, because you're like, you assume, because dragons are attacking, that somehow Jeremy Irons has caused dragons to attack, but no, he's the one being attacked by her dragon. So you're right, like, by getting the staff, Ridley has just fucked everything up, because he gets the staff and then, like, teleports right to this tower where this whole climax is going on, and then friggin' Profion gets the staff, and then he can control all the red dragons.
Well, I guess to be a little fair, I think once Ridley comes out of that cave with the staff, which also isn't a staff, it's like this red curvy, or rod. It's not a rod, it's not a staff, I don't know what it is. It's made of plastic. But he comes out of the cave with it, and then Damodar is there, and again, he's captured Marina and whoever right. else, and then he has to trade the rod for their lives. And so then,
Right.
Now Damodar is able to open a portal back to Profion. Oh my God, these names. And so Profion gets the rod and he can control the red dragons. But here's my question. Thora Birch, does she use another rod to control the gold dragons?
She has a golden rod. Yes, I believe so.
God. It's just a little weird that she wants to, like, kind of level the playing field and bring equality to non-mages. But then she's also, like, controlling these dragons into battle, I assume against their will, with this rod. Doesn't that seem like a little at cross purposes?
It feels like something they couldn't even justify, so they didn't even bother. I mean, I have to assume that there's cut scenes, or there were scenes and they intended to do and they just couldn't do it. They lost their funding or whatever, who knows. But also, I just think they had no way to logically have this make sense. So it's like, well, whatever, just cut to a dragon siege. You know, that's what everybody's here for, right? And I mean, this dragon siege is terrible. I mean, if you thought the dragon at the beginning was bad, like, now there's like hundreds of them, and it just really looks like a terrible PS1 game sequence or something. It looks awful. I think this is the worst climax to a fantasy film ever.
Wow.
I hate everything about this. This is terrible. So while this is going on, you know, they're all just standing on this set that has obviously a bunch of green screen around it so that we can get this awful dragons flying around in the background. And, like, the sound is, like, jacked up so that you're constantly hearing this, like, swooshing, and you can't hear half of the shit anybody says, not that you'd want to hear it. So Ridley's got to fight Damodar. So, and before that, for whatever reason, I guess Jeremy Irons frees Damodar from the earworms or whatever. I'm not even sure what's going on there. Yeah. I thought he was going to kill him or whatever, but I don't even know. And so then he's fighting him with the sword, and so he beats him and tosses him off the tower, just like he tossed snails off the tower. So, you know, we get some dramatic irony there. And then he's got a sword fight Jeremy Irons' staff. And so we get another boring sword fight. And all the, like, action in this is terrible. None of it's good or well choreographed. Nobody looks that believable wielding anything. The cuts are really quick and everything. Honestly, the combination of all of this in this climax makes me hate fantasy. Like, it makes me want to burn all my fantasy novels and just, like, read nothing but, like, John Updike books for the rest of my life. You know, like, I just want to read stories about, like, failing marriages or something. Like, just anything that's not fantasy. It makes me hate the genre, this whole wow. mess.
Well, I mean, I do not like this movie. I'm not that down on the ending just because it's the ending of the movie. So I know this is all going to be over soon enough, or I hope. But yeah, the dragon fight is terrible. And I think, you know, they obviously had a limited budget. But as you said before, the title is Dungeons and Dragons. So all technically we need to see are two dungeons and two dragons. So if they had just redistributed the budget to just make like two semi-okay dragons instead of dozens of really bad kind of gummy worm-looking dragons, I would have chosen option A on that.
That's a good call. I wish you had been a producer on this movie because you would have straightened things out. I know we've said this before and we'll say it again. This is not to belittle the work of the people who worked on these things. You and I have both worked in the industry. We know how it goes. It's not the people doing the CG's fault. It's the budget. It's the lack of resources. But we're the ones watching the movies. We're suffering and we have to make our feelings known. Honestly, this is some of the worst CG I've ever seen put into a theatrically released movie. This is way worse than a lot of even direct-to-video stuff that we would have seen around this time. You know, like, it's just terrible.
If this was a direct-to-DVD movie or something, it would be a little more forgivable. But I'm just even thinking, like, the portals that the wizards travel through, sorry, the mages travel through in this, they're really bad. And Time Cop came out years before and had kind of a similar effect, but way better. And just so many of the other, the way characters disappear and they make magic ropes appear, it's just all really, really bad. And I think the budget was at least 30 something or maybe 40 something. I mean, that's
45.
Not, yeah, that's not nothing from back then. No. I just don't know where all the money went.
I suspect shady business deals with foreign investors and stuff like that. Because, I mean, most of the money came from foreign investors. And it, as admirable as it was that Courtney Solomon got this movie made, it sounds like he, you know, had to go through some questionable sources to raise the money. I'm willing to bet, you know, financing fell through at points and he probably thought he was going to have way more than he did. And he was inexperienced. So like you're saying, he didn't really know how to well allocate things anyway.
Sure.
You know, you can just see the problems building up. A more experienced director would have come in and been like, no, we can't do this. You know, let's have one dragon and have it look really good. Spend more on the dragons, less on the dungeons, whatever, you know, like it's just bad business, really, is what it is.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the ridiculously terrible denouement. So after all this CGI barf.
It is barf. You know, just even like the sky, the color of the sky during the dragon battle, it's like this weird like brown shade. It's very unappealing.
Yeah, I've had episodes of vomit that looked more visually appealing than some of this CG here. But yeah, we descend into a solemn graveyard and Ridley's standing there in his cool new black outfit, because he's now been made a knight or something, Sir Ridley, like Sir Ridley Scott. He's in this graveyard, which looks like it's a real graveyard. It's probably somewhere in the Czech Republic where I think they filmed most of this movie.
Right.
I think I've actually been in graveyards that look like this in Europe. Far more enjoyable experiences to spend an afternoon in one of these graveyards than to watch this movie and think about your own inevitable death. So he's standing before Snails' grave. And so you have all these like really old gravestones, but apparently in his new knighthood, he couldn't afford any more for poor Snails than like a pile of rocks. And the top rock has Snails sort of crudely etched upon it, right? And so he's having this sad, I made it, buddy, conversation with Snails. The rest of the characters showed up. Oh, and I should mention that, you know, in the big battle that took place in the tower, we did get like one moment where the rest of the party showed up just to be like instantly incapacitated by Jeremy Irons.
Right.
They just show up and he just like shoots some magic or whatever. So that's all they did. They've done nothing.
Big help.
So here they are kind of doing nothing, sitting in the background. And then he puts the eye of the dragon.
Looks like a giant red jelly bean.
Right. He puts it down on Snails' crude grave and says, you finally got it, buddy, or something like that. Like, you finally got the big score or whatever. And then some sort of magic comes out of the eye. And then the Snails that is etched upon the rocks just disappears, like as if Tinkerbell had waved her wand or something like that. And then the elf ranger says, your friend is waiting for you. And then more magic comes out of the rock, and then they all just disappear into like these trails of light, and they go off into the netherworld, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, did she mean like your friend is waiting for you in heaven and now you're all dead and we're all in heaven together? I don't know. And not to be ungrateful, but like, if it's this magic artifact and it brings snails back to life, couldn't it just bring him to life there? Like, now they have to go out and do the search for snails or whatever?
No, because I guarantee you Marlon Wayans did not want to have another moment on set of this film. I guarantee you he was like, fuck no, I'm not filming another scene. You find some other way to hint that my character is still alive and that the Dungeons and Dragons 2 is going to be the search for snails or whatever the fuck it is. He didn't want to come back. He was out. He was out. He was not even going to show up as a force ghost. Nothing. You're not getting nothing from Marlon at this point.
Well, you know, it's an ending, I guess. I was fine with snails being dead. You know, like it was, I didn't have to hear any more of the annoying banter. And it was kind of the one thing that had any sort of emotional resonance to it. And now that's been taken away too.
But, you know, hey, Courtney Solomon felt good enough about this movie to give himself a directed by credit at the very end. Like, usually I notice that really bad movies will shamefully just, like, cut to credits and it'll be like, unit production manager, yeah, or whatever will be, like, the first one to come up. But no, Courtney Solomon's, like, directed by Courtney Solomon. Like it's a fucking Christopher Nolan movie or some shit.
Well, I'll give him credit. You know, he willed this thing into being and he's made more movies than I have. And apparently this is a trilogy.
So, Richard, why did this fail? Just kidding. We're not going to do that.
Please don't make me relive this again. I just can't take it.
We're going to play a different game. We're going to play the game of, is this the worst film Tentpole Trauma has ever covered? Richard, what do you think?
What's an interesting question. I'm going to say it at least ties for first place. And I would say the other movie that it ties with is from my very first episode on here, Battlefield Earth. I think those are the two worst movies you've ever covered on your entire show.
On one hand, I think Battlefield Earth is worse because just on a filmmaking level, like that movie feels like it's almost completely unprofessional, you know, like, yeah, with all the sort of Dutch angles and it feels like somebody who didn't know how to make a movie made a movie. This has that too, but I feel like until you reach the third act climax, it's just kind of a bad movie, right? Like it's your sort of garden variety bad movie with some occasional moments of true awfulness, right? Whereas Battlefield Earth is terrible. It's sort of a steady terrible, right? Yeah. That's like really bad throughout the whole thing. Whereas this kind of goes in fits and starts. Like it's never good. This movie is never good, but there are moments where it's more or less doing what it's supposed to be doing. You know, like I don't feel like Battlefield Earth is ever doing what it's supposed to be doing.
That's a fair point. I think like Dungeons and Dragons is sort of bookended by the two worst scenes, which is the opening with the bad dragon and the closing bad dragon battle.
Yeah.
Battlefield Earth is not only consistently bad, I think it gets worse and worse as it goes on and as your anger as a viewer rises.
Yeah.
Battlefield Earth, I can't remember what the budget was on that. I'm sure it was bigger than Dungeons and Dragons. And it had bigger stars.
Definitely, right. So there's kind of more shame involved there.
Yeah.
I also feel that Battlefield Earth is longer. Without like just looking at the running times of both movies, this is like an hour and 47 minutes with credits, whereas I'm pretty sure Battlefield Earth goes over 2 hours, right?
I think so.
So right there, that's more offensive, right?
Right.
You're suffering through more movie. You're wasting more of your life watching it. This movie, while it's terrible, it doesn't feel like it necessarily drags in the way that Battlefield Earth does. I mean, maybe you feel differently about it.
I mean, they both drag. Battlefield Earth, that was definitely positioned more to be a tentpole movie. Like, it was a big summer release, right? Whereas I don't think anyone thought Dungeons & Dragons, the 2000 version, was going to be a hit. I don't remember what time of year it came out, but it just didn't have that air around it.
I mean, they were hoping, I think, you know, I mean, they were hoping it was going to be a blockbuster, probably a sleeper blockbuster, but no, I don't think anybody was thinking it really would be. And I mean, the fantasy genre was so moribund at this point, you know, I mean, fantasy films had been in the toilet forever, whereas Battlefield Earth was a big sci-fi movie. And at that point in time, sci-fi was a much more viable genre. And, you know, it wouldn't be until a year later when Lord of the Rings happened that fantasy got sort of revived.
Right.
So, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think anybody was probably expecting much out of Dungeons & Dragons, whereas they were probably expecting a lot out of Battlefield Earth.
But I would say they're both movies that, like, I don't ever want to see again, if I can help it. Yeah, because, I mean, you've covered it. Like, I'm thinking of Exorcist 2. Like, that's a weird movie, but I kind of like rewatching it or having it playing in the background.
I love Exorcist too.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that with Dungeons and Dragons or Battlefield.
So before we close out here, the whole reason we're doing this is that the new Dungeons and Dragons movie is coming out. I have enjoyed the trailers. I'm a big fan of Chris Pine. I like all the cast, and I'm hearing really good things. How are you feeling about this new Dungeons & Dragons movie?
Yeah, I agree. I have high hopes for it. You know, I think the writer-directors are really good. I think they did Game Night, which
they did.
I really enjoyed, and I sort of actually think that sets them up to be really great directors for Dungeons & Dragons movie, because Game Night was entertaining, but it also, if you have participated in Game Nights, it sort of felt like that. It kind of created some of the experience of that.
Yeah.
I think they also wrote or were some of the writers on Spider-Man Homecoming, which I really like. That's one of my favorite Marvel movies. So yeah, I'm all for it. And the 2000 movie has not dissuaded me any, amazingly. Although it's made me very angry at you, Sebastian. I resent you for this.
As well you should. Well, I mean, unfortunately, Richard, you sort of positioned yourself as the person to talk about fantasy sword and sorcery movies. No one else will really go there with me, and I had to do it because of the movie, so you got stuck with the dubious honor. I am sorry. I will try to make it up to you next time. We'll cover something else that won't be terrible, hopefully. I'll make it up to you. And I really appreciate you taking the hit here and talking about this dumb fucking movie with me.
Well, I wish I could say no problem, but it was a problem. It was a huge problem. And you're on thin ice, O'Brien.
I'm happy to Venmo you the cost of the rental, because no one should have had to pay to watch this movie.
Well, no, I'm glad we got to talk about it. It gave me some sense of closure. And let's just never discuss it again.
All right, well, I'm going to go eat some chicken really sloppily and take some Profion and steal myself a throbbing magic rod.
If you take enough Profion, you don't need to steal the rod. You're just going to have your own.
That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows? One day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.